August 25th, 2011. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight, my featured guest will be Kerdwin Fallingstar, who is a distinguished teacher and facilitator in the Northern California goddess-centered neo-pagan community. And we met her at a recent Farifarian conclave north of San Francisco. Of special interest to our hermetic magical process is the inspiration behind Lady Kerdwin's magical historical novels. She channels them, recounting her own adventures from past lives. But she also does very good historical research, and she has a professional novelist style and storytelling flair. Her first novel was The Heart of Fire, recounting the life of a Scottish witch in the 16th century. And she then moved to medieval Japan for a two-decker saga, White as Bone, Red as Blood. Now, we're especially interested in the methods she used to recover these memories. So, as I said in the abstract, tune in and we'll find out how to go way, way back and live it up. Now, Kerdwin's going to call in about another 9 minutes. And before that time, before she calls in, I don't want to embarrass her by praising her too highly here. As those of you know who are regular listeners to this program, that I am a what you would call a professional novelist. I had two novels published by New York publishers, and I had a series of adventure stories running in Argosy magazine. So I am a what you call a professional fiction writer. And I must say that that Lady Kerdwin certainly is a professional. She really knows how to tell a story, and she knows how to get you involved. She knows how to keep the pace going. She knows how to make it convincing. Her dialogue is realistic. She knows how to play on all the emotions, what we call in writing emotional loading. She knows how to do all of this, and she does it very, very, very well. So these books are not just filled with special information from an occult point of view, because she is, of course, an accomplished Wiccan practitioner and teacher. But it's not only that, but they are very, very good stories and very, very well done. She's charming and very knowledgeable, and I'm really looking forward to having an in-depth discussion with her. But what I'm particularly interested in is the channeling process, because I've done a little bit of this sort of thing myself, and let it influence my fiction. And I take the same approach that she does. The idea is not just to have your vision and go back in time, and that whatever you come up with, that's got to be the right thing, and you put it out. I like to make sure, and so does Lady Kerdwin, that the historical aspects of this are correct. And so therefore, we research, and then the research stimulates the channeling, and the channeling calls for more research, and we fine-tune it with the research so that it comes across as a very powerful and realistic. So many times, occult, even some famous occult channeled works, are somewhat embarrassing to read because of the inauthenticity of the, that was in ancient Egypt, and all that. They don't know anything about ancient Egypt, it's obvious. But in this case, Lady Kerdwin, she has done her homework. She does her homework while she's in the process. This is the way I like to do it. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it. We even have an article in the New Seventh Ray, which takes the opposite approach, that you chant and in the ancient language, and you don't research, you chant the ancient language, bring it through, and you don't do the research, because if you do, then you're liable to add suggestions rather than get the real thing. I think that's a valid approach. But the approach that Lady Kirdwin uses, and the approach that I like to use, is a mixture of inspiration and good old-fashioned research. And so, this first novel that she wrote, I haven't really gotten into Heart of the Fire. I was working on the Japanese novels, The White as Bone, Red as Blood, and I looked at The Heart of Fire, and I skimmed it over, and I found some interesting things in it that we'll discuss when our distinguished author calls in. Kirdwin, go ahead if you're listening. Go ahead and give us a call. You know our guest call-in number, 347-857-1830. And give us a call in, and we'll get going on this because I know that we, in this particular instance, we'd all much rather listen to you than listen to me, because you're the lady who has done this and been there and done it, and so we'll get going on that. Heart of Fire, that was your first book, and I'm looking at it here. It came out in 1990, and it's published by Cauldron Publications in San Geronimo, California. And essentially, this is, Kirdwin told me that she channeled this along with another member of her coven, and the two of them worked together because they both felt that they had previous incarnations in this period, and that they had known each other during the period, and so they both worked together. So that's a very unique thing about this book, is it's not just Kirdwin's channeling, but also the channeling of this other lady who she worked with. So that is remarkably unusual. While we're waiting for her to call in, I want to mention some other channeled works that are interesting and are along the same line. One of them, I'm sure, we've all heard of, and that's Dweller on Two Planets. And that's the one that we used for Beyond Lemuria. That's was channeled by Frederick Spencer Oliver up on the slopes of Mount Shasta back in 1887, I think. He started when he was 17 years old, and he got in contact with Philos the Atlantean Adept and channeled that. That's a remarkable book. It has some flaws, and it's a little dated. I think Kirdwin's writing is, of course, much easier to get into and follow, and much more contemporary in a style, as far as the style is concerned. But there's Dweller on Two Planets. That's a famous channeled work. Another one I might mention, Jack London. And Jack London did a very unusual novel called The Star Rover. And The Star Rover involves prisoners in San Quentin back before World War I. And these prisoners were subjected to a particularly uncomfortable form of solitary confinement in which they were put in straitjackets. And this would, under certain circumstances, drive the prisoner absolutely insane. They'd get frantic in solitary confinement in these straitjackets. So they developed a method for putting themselves into trance and entering the inner planes and going into past lives. And Lady Kirdwin, are you with us?
I am with you.
Oh, good, good. Because I was just discussing Jack London's Star Rover, and I'd mentioned dweller in two planets. So let's get right into talking about your books and how we do it. Would you give us an idea of how let's say start with Heart of Fire, how this came about and how you developed it?
Well, the Heart of the Fire is the first of the past life historical novels that I wrote, and that one came out originally in 1990, and it sold over 20,000 copies. I had memories of a life in which I was in Scotland, 16th century Scotland, although I didn't know, of course, the era when I first started having the memories, because I was only 3 and 4 years old, and I remember talking to my parents at that age and saying, "Oh, I'm so glad we're rich now." And they said, "Oh, honey, we're not rich." And I patted the rug and I said, "Look, we have rug on the floor instead of dirt, and we eat meat every day." And then I went and turned on the hot water. I said, "Hot water whenever we want it. We're rich." And my parents were like, "Whoa, where'd we get this kid?" You know, because we didn't have a television or anything. I had no access to the sort of information that I had, but I was remembering a time where we had lived in a place with a dirt floor and we had to walk a long way and get water out of a hole in the ground, and sometimes we went hungry, and clearly things had improved since then. I wasn't aware that it was a different life and that I had died in between, but I did have very strong memories from an early time. So those memories started getting stronger when I was working, when I became a practicing witch in this lifetime, this current lifetime. And my second coven started encouraging me as I started having more and more of these memories spontaneously, and I was writing them down, and they said, "Well, this is going to make a great book." And initially I said, "Book? Oh, this is my personal past life. It's not a book." And they said, "No, this is a book. You have this unique capacity to dip back into the past very vividly, much more vividly than most of us. So it's up to you to turn this into a book." So that was how that one came about.
Well, what you're saying is very, very interesting. When you correct me if I'm wrong now, the first thing you realized was that you had to walk through the woods to a spring or a well or something like this to draw water, and that was the first memory that you had, right?
Yeah, it's kind of probably a little collection of memories, but just a memory of being in another place. But I wasn't really aware that it was also another time, because I was a very small child, and it wasn't like my parents, were talking about reincarnation or anything. It wasn't like anyone I was growing up around was providing me with a framework to understand what was going on.
Are you familiar with Dick Sutphin? He used to call himself the Malibu Shaman.
Sounds familiar, but I can't say that I'm very
familiar. Well, I think he's been retired for a while. But Dick Sutphin had a series of lessons on how to access past lives. The reason why I asked you about drawing water was that one of the things he came up with, which I've had very, very good luck with in age regression, is when you get the person back, if you're doing this hypnotically, you get the person back, and you tell them, now you're in this previous lifetime, look down at your feet. What kind of shoes are you, or footwear or not, what are you wearing on your feet? And this way...
That's something I do with my clients.
Yeah, it's a great idea, because then they aren't loading them. Then they're seeing what's really there, And then you go from there, and then you start looking at what you're wearing, and you start moving around. And this is why I ask you, here's this woman going out to draw water, and you wonder, now what is this? And it develops from there. So it's a very, very real way of, very effective way of doing it. You told me that in Heart of Fire, you not only channeled this yourself, but you found out that one of the ladies in your coven was also involved in this. And of course, as we all know, covens are supposed to attract kindred souls like that, which is part of the process. And the two of you then started working on this together.
Yeah, this was a woman in my first coven, actually, named Isis, who had started spontaneously having memories with me. And she had been the character Mina in my book. So in the previous lifetime, she had been considerably older, my grandmother's contemporary. But in our current lifetime, we were the same age. We were contemporaries. And interestingly, she's also a very close friend with Starhawk, and Starhawk is the one who introduced us to each other. And when she first showed up at my doorstep in this lifetime, she's a beautiful black woman. You know, I opened the door, and we immediately fell into each other's arms. I started hugging and hugging and hugging each other. And you know, one of the other of us, I don't remember which, said, "Wait, who are you? Why are we doing this?" And the other one said, "I don't know." And then we just kept hugging each other. We had such an intense sense of recognition. It wasn't a sexual attraction. It wasn't that. It was just some intense heart connection, intense recognition. And so, you know, but we didn't know at that moment. At that moment, it wasn't clear to us, you know, why we had such an intensive connection. But later on, that became more clear. At some point, we were doing a psychic reading together, and suddenly she started speaking kind of from her old persona, and I started speaking from my old persona. I was speaking from Fiona's point of view, and she from Mina's, and suddenly we just dropped back. You know, we just dropped back 400 years, and we were in that other time and place, and it was really a very, very intense magical experience.
Now, did you feel like this was ancestral or reincarnational in the Eastern sense, which is not ancestral?
No, it was reincarnational. You know, it was very specific. You know, that she was there and I was there. We were two different people, but we were we had been together. Yeah.
But what I want to ask you is that they're two different people. But do you feel that this was related to a bloodline, or do you feel that it was that it's reincarnational in that non bloodline sense that the Easterners use?
Yeah, this was reincarnational in the non bloodline sense. Although, you know, I do have some Scottish ancestry, and she may have a small amount. Also, but it was definitely not incarnating along the same lines. I mean, sometimes people do incarnate along their family lines. That's not an uncommon thing to happen either, but not in this particular case. Yeah.
Well, the reason why I ask that is that there is, I'm not going to mention the name of the tradition, but it's one of the traditions, the new Wiccan tradition that comes over from England. It developed right after World War II. And probably before World War II, but they believe that individuals can reincarnate in the same coven. You're familiar with that idea. That's why I asked that question. And there is, there's a lot of not controversy, but because both can obtain. Myself, I'm willing to have all kinds of reincarnations as far as I'm concerned. Something I'd like to ask you this now, and I must admit now, I haven't had a chance to read Heart of Fire, but I have skimmed through it, you know. I've skimmed and whatever. I've got more into the Japanese one. But I ran across something on page 421 and 422 that really, really fascinates me, and I want to ask you about it. Down at the bottom of page 421, we have, "She calls to Astoreth, the maiden of shadows and fire, merging me with the goddess in her mind, and I begin to chant for courage. Millstone and barley, cup and wine, let the love of my lips be the grapes on thy vine, Astoreth. Sweet sting of honey, intoxicant mead. Here come, we call at need, Astoreth, hunter and hunted, arrow and bow, dying and borning, these secrets you know, Ashtoreth. I will the power of Ashtoreth to her, and she becomes it, rising from pain, hands firm on the bow of her will, her thank you calm and clear, her strong heart throbbing in my chest. Now, gracious lady, I love it, but how does our Phoenician love goddess, who of course became a Jewish and Christian demon, not for her fault, but I mean she was
no, not,
she,
not her fault.
Absolutely not her fault. But how does she get over to Scotland in the 16th century?
Well, again, if you read the book, you'll see that in that lifetime, Fiona and Annie frequently time traveled together and used to drop into other lives, and they'd get bits and pieces of information from these other lives that then became kind of part of their secret their secret growing into magic, and so they had some interesting bits and pieces float up to them from other times, so it makes a little more sense in the context of the of the whole thing. When you read the whole thing, you see that while they were in their own time and place, they occasionally dropped into other times and places.
Robert Graves would certainly agree with you, and I imagine you've heard of Roy Bowers, who wrote under the name of Robert Cochrane or Cochran. And he was a fellow that started the Robert Graves type coven called or witchcraft tradition called the Order of 1734, which eventually became the American Roebuck, or at least just an outgroup of it. But Robert Cochrane mixed Phoenician elements, biblical elements, into his Celtic witchcraft tradition. And
oh,
you know,
interesting. I didn't know that.
I did Tubal Cain, for instance, who was actually originally Kusur, the Phoenician craftsman god, who becomes Tubal Cain in the Bible, and then becomes and gets transported. So there's a thing that fascinates me about you using Ashtoreth here is that yes, I can see where they would, because obviously, the Bible is going to have influence on these folks, I think it would.
That's quite probably true too.
Oh yeah, and it makes it more authentic as far as I'm concerned. I think that's wonderful. Of course, I also like you using our patron goddess. That's nice too. But tell me some more about your concept of what Scottish Wicca was like in those days. How close would it be to what Graves, what Gardner's describing in High Magic's Aid or something like that?
Oh boy, I don't know if I've even read Gardner's High Magic Aid, so I'm not sure if I could actually address
It's not important because it isn't all that good, believe me, but anyway, I'm just kind of using that as a spinoff. I would kind of, how close do you think, one of the things about Wicca these days is, regardless of how balanced or how goddess-oriented or how well-balanced it might be in this sense, it owes a lot, the structure of it, owes a lot to Freemasonry, the idea of the 3 degrees and all of that kind of thing. I'm wondering, did the covenants in those days have one initiation, or how did they work?
I was only aware of one, but that doesn't mean that there might not have been something else that was revealed later as you became older. You know, the initial initiation just into the coven is the only one that I personally was aware of. But I was very young and didn't live to in that lifetime to be very old, in which case it's entirely possible the older people had many tricks up their sleeves that they hadn't taught us yet, So I can only see it from kind of my own point of view, which is, you know, I only knew about the one, but it doesn't 100% mean that there wasn't more, but it wasn't, you know, it was, you know, it was a very, you know, I think the what I knew about was, you know, very much, you know, a coven that was just, you know, based on the village where I lived, you know, and it was that particular, you know, it was the village coven. It was that group of magic working people who very occasionally, very rarely, as times became more dangerous, met with people from other groups, you know, a little bit further away. So it may have been, you know, I'm guessing that there might have been a lot of variation between groups, because there was very little contact, I think, between groups. So I'm imagining that they may have been very idiosyncratic in certain ways.
Well, this also too tends to lend it more of an air of authenticity. I think I'm sure you know that Margaret Murray, when she came up with The God of the Witches, way back, I think it was 1920 something or other, 1930, she came up with that, and all of the whole anthropological community came down on her.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Oh, for heaven's sake, there wasn't any great big interconnected European and British pagan tradition. They all had little traditions. They were all kind of little individual idea." That they're probably right in that respect. I know that Murray, is from a romantic point of view, it might be nice to think that Murray was correct, that there was one sort of interconnected pagan tradition at that time, but you're probably closer to the mark on the way you're doing it, and because it's the same situation, I'm afraid, with trying to recover Siberian shamanism. Whatever interconnected quality it had, it looks like the Soviets completely, you know, virtually stamped it out.
Mm-hmm.
So now the Siberian shamans are relearning shamanism via Carlos Castaneda. So that sounds like it's more authentic. Now, this part about your Japanese, is double-decker Japanese. So why does bone red as blood, and the first one's the fox sorceress, and the second one's the storm god?
Mm-hmm.
I got into the fox sorceress, and I had difficulty putting it down. It just really carries you right along. It's beautifully, beautifully written. Would you tell us how that developed and where we're going with it?
Oh, thanks. I was extremely fascinated by everything Japanese when I was a kid, and I'm white in this lifetime, and so it wasn't exactly coming from anything in my immediate vicinity, but that I would frequently dress up as Japanese for Halloween and want to dye my hair black and things of that nature. And then again, when I was in my second coven, there was a woman in that coven who I had known in a past life, and we strongly felt that we had known each other in some Japanese past life. And in that case, I knew nothing about Japanese history at all, as most Western people don't. So we started with some Japanese art books that she had, and I kind of paged through until I found the art that looked right, and then I started researching the history based on the art, and then I started, you know, uncovering the things that matched my memories, which was kind of shocking. It always kind of surprises me, even though I've done it so many times now. It always kind of gives me the chicken skin, as the Hawaiians would call it, whenever I find something in a history book that I've already written about or already been talking about to someone else. It's very poignant and very intense for me to realize that I am indeed channeling stuff that actually happened, even though I have no way of having known about it in any kind of traditional way. I always, you know, with my books, I always get the initial information from the past life work, which I go into hypnosis to obtain, and then I start, and but then I back it up with lots and lots of research to establish that I am correct in what I'm remembering.
Well, one thing I will say about, because I say a lot of good things about this pair of books, but one thing that I am very impressed with is your obvious grasp of Japanese. I thought we might be having a technical problem here.
Yeah, we were for a while.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you now.
Oh, good. As I say, this is not. There's nothing fluffy bunny about these books. These are really sophisticated adult, very very well done, and it really has the feel of medieval Japan. I mean, and the terror of it also too, and a good title: White as Bone, Red as Blood. But the writing, the beauty of Japan too, and your writing style, that you capture their love of beauty and their love of harmony and their love of the oneness with nature. And they, although I don't know whether the Japanese have anything like feng shui, but they tend to want to live that way. You know, they want to live that way even with the violence of the culture. They still strive for a beautiful harmony, and you got that beautifully described.
So I
think that. But you know, one of the things that really fascinates me from the channeling point of view here, and I mentioned it to you when we were discussing this earlier. You said that when you started channeling this, when you started really getting into this after the artwork had started you off, that you would costume yourself in as close as you could come to the garb of the period and make yourself up to look like this lady in medieval Japan with the hair.
That was just when I was a kid. No, when I was a kid, I would dress up. I didn't dress up when I was researching the book.
Oh, okay.
Although I do have some kimonos, and I enjoy wearing them, but it wasn't something I would do to, you know, before going into trance or anything like that. That was
but
just when I was a little kid. I would dress up, and then I would look in the mirror, and it would start triggering my memories, you know. But that was when I was a small kid and didn't have any more sophisticated means of accessing the memories. Although, actually, when you think about it, that was a kind of a fairly sophisticated way for a 9 or 10 year old kid to go about time traveling. It's not something I did when I was actually writing the book or researching the book.
Well, when you were writing the book, did you use the dark mirror technique at all?
No, when I was writing the book, I create a trance tape for myself. And I listen to the trance tape, and that puts me into the trance state. And it instructs me then to change tapes. So then I change tapes in the tape recorder, and then I start talking everything that I'm experiencing into that tape. And then I transcribe the tapes. And then, of course, I rewrite it a million times to make it into actual literature.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the process that I use now. But certainly using a dark mirror or crystal ball is, you know, a way that I can access past lives and a way that I've taught other people to access past lives. So it's a very, very interesting access point, I think.
Long outline that the dark mirror with the candles is used in India to bring up previous incarnations. It's used in West Africa to bring up visions of your ancestors. It's used in present-day Southern California to bring up goetic spirits. I think it was used, of course, as far back as Catalhoyuk. We have polished obsidian, dark mirrors that we probably use. It's a very, very old technique. But I thought you didn't actually use the mirror in the process when you were writing the book as an adult.
No, I did not.
Yeah.
Just more direct to just put myself into trance, you know, auditorially. It's a more direct method for me.
Yeah. And this particular one, though, you didn't have anybody else working with you as a channeler. This is your
right,
own.
Right. For my first book, you know, for the Heart of the Fire, another member of that second coven did a lot of the trance work with me. She used to call it going to the movies. help me go in and, you know, kind of babysit me while I went through the process. But
yeah.
That was less than efficient, having to depend on another person. So as I developed trance tapes to help me with the Japanese one.
Well, yeah, the Fox Sorceress takes her up to about what age is when the Fox Sorceress ends her? She's still pretty young.
Yeah, she's still fairly young. Let's see. She ends in, I think, 1178, and she's probably about 11 years old in 1160, so...
Yeah, but she's still
she's probably in her late 20s, maybe.
Yeah, and then the storm god, where the pace frickens and that everything's resolved, the storm god. So that takes her through to about what age time track?
Takes her to 1185, so she would have been in her 30s at that point.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, one of the things your writing style, especially when you start off, you use very short chapters, and that's really good. That's really good. I don't care how exciting a book is, if the chapters or a novel is, if the chapters are too long, the reader tends to bog down. It isn't, and the short chapters really, really help, especially when you get started. Because that way you have that transition between chapters where you can actually do a time jump and so it acts almost as a cut. You know, you can almost if your agent or your editor says you got to cut it, you know, and shorter chapters are really the way to do it. I think as you start off, like I said, it's all you can't put this book down hardly.
Thank you. I'm glad you feel that way about it.
Yeah, it's really, really, really well done. I'm as I say, I'm fascinated because, you know, I think every magician and every witch that I know has written some kind of a magical novel or something like that, and some of them are good. And some of them are okay, and a lot of the, you know, they all have valuable insiders kind of insights, obviously. But it's so seldom that you run into someone who has the insider's track and also is channeling, and then on top of all of that, they can write a really, really good story. That's a very unusual talent, and that's what you've managed to do. I'm really, as I say, I'm quite impressed. Now, tell us about your other activities. I understand you have you're teaching in Northern California, and you're also teaching up in, where is it, Portland?
Yeah, Portland, Oregon. Yeah, I've been, you know, teaching for many, many years at this point, but I'm based in Marin County, California, so the majority of my classes have been in that area. But one of the classes that I do is called A Year and a Day, and it's a year-long apprenticeship program, a shamanic apprenticeship program. And for the first time, I'm going to be offering that in the Portland, Oregon area, and the first class is going to be October 2nd. So we're still, the class is still open. I have room for a few more people. And it is kind of the first opportunity that people in that area have had will have had to work with me consistently over the course of a year. It's basically one full day a year and 13 classes in all. So it's a class that I would have given absolutely anything to have when I was first starting out in magic, because I first started in 1975 when I was 22 years old, and at that point, you know, most people were in the broom closet. It was very hard to meet people, and you know, it was, and there wasn't nearly as much written material available as well, and so I feel like I sort of had to reinvent the wheel a lot of the time as I was coming along, and so it's very valuable, I think, if you can work with, you know, a trustworthy teacher who can kind of
How are you going to commute between?
Well, I'm going to fly. I'm going to fly up on my broom, of course,
yeah.
Poe.
Yeah. Well, you're going to fly on a broom.
I'll be flying up and. It's going to be a modern type airline type room, I think.
A Cessna room, maybe. That'll be good. Turn the crank to where it goes. But that sounds fascinating. And you're by the way, you know, I was asking Joe the other day. Do you know about Harner's shaman thing there in Mill Valley? Are you familiar with that?
I know he teaches up here. You know, I haven't actually taken any of his classes. I've always thought that I would, but I haven't gotten around or studied with many people, but I've never actually studied with Michael Harner. But you know, speaking of Joe Carson, you know, she did a pretty amazing movie called Dancing with Gaia, and I'm one of the many really interesting magical people that she focuses that movie on. So I would also very much recommend to your check out
plugging that right
Gaia.
On along. And in fact, I have a good review on that in the seventh ray, and thank you for adding that, because we're really encouraging everybody to get a copy of that video. That's excellent. It's just really, really good. But do you have, now, you have a website yourself, don't you? And
that
are interested in your program mm-hmm. go to.
Yeah,
so,
my website is www.caredwinfallingstar.com, and I also do individual sessions. I do phone readings, so even if you are far away, you can still call and get a phone reading. And then I do, you know, personal readings, and I also do soul retrieval, which is a traditional shamanic healing technique, and I also offer hypnosis or trance work, and we can do past life work that way, but there's a lot of other applications as well. Sometimes people want to work on their childhood issues, or they want to work on a dream that they've had. There's all kinds of interesting applications with hypnosis work, So I do some quite a bit of individual counseling with people, and I also, you know, I perform weddings and do funerals and, you know, all those things. Since I do have a ministerial credential, I've been working in this path for a very long time.
Yeah, well, that's good. Now, give us that website again, and so we can put our pencils on it.
www.caredwinfallingstar.com, and Caredwin is CERRIDWEN, and Falling Star is, of course, like it sounds, FALLING.
That's what I want you to do. I want you to spell it, because unfortunately, Google's pretty good at getting. If you misspell something, Google probably will get you there. But unfortunately, URLs have got to be exactly right, and so thanks for that out now.
You know, when I was in Scotland researching my first book, at one point I was making a long-distance call home, reversing the charges, and it sounded like this little old Scottish man was the operator, and he said, "So what's your name, then?" And I said, "It's Caredwin." And he said, "Caredwin? You must be a witch, then." And I laughed and said, "Well, as a matter of fact, yes." And he started laughing like heck. He said, I knew it. So in Scotland, yeah, they're a little more familiar with that name, but not so much here.
Well, it's a beautiful, beautiful name. And what I want to, in the time we have remaining, we're you know, we got about, I guess, about 11 minutes left here. What I want to do is I want to go over again, summarize, because in a good presentation, what is it you're going to do? You tell them what you're going to tell them, and then you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. I mean, that's the formula. At least that's the formula in technical writing that Sandra and I will be involved in years. Okay, so you are Carid Wynn Falling Star, and you are the author of The Heart of Fire, which is a novel, a great big satisfying hunk of a novel here. A channel novel on a Scottish witch in the 16th century. That's the 1500s. For those of you, who don't know what, and that was your first novel, and that one is the one that I mentioned is it's got my favorite patron goddess Ashtoreth in there, which I like. And then we discussed your double-decker medieval Japanese novel, which is also a channeled work, White as Bone and Red as Blood. And the first one's called The Fox Sorceress, and the second one is called The Storm God. Now, all of these are available on Amazon, aren't they?
Yes, they're available on Amazon, and or you can get them directly through me, or you can order them from your bookstore. The first book, The Heart of the Fire, is available through New Leaf, if they're wondering who's distributing it. And the Japanese ones can be ordered through Barnes & Noble, as well as through Amazon.
Oh, that's good. Does New Leaf handle your Amazon? I'm going to ask you that question. That's not getting a little too technical. Anyway,
we're hoping to have them available for on Kindle or one of those. We're kind of waiting to see what the more popular variant is for being able to download the novels. But we will try and make them available for downloading as soon as possible.
Well,
but then you would miss the beautiful covers, and the covers are really pretty.
I know the covers, and then let me mention that the cover art on all three of them, the cover art is just really outstanding, and I'm looking at two of them, The Heart of Fire and The Fox Sorceress right now, and it's just the artwork is just beautiful. You're very fortunate to have gotten that. Have the connections to get that artwork. That's just beautiful. So the other thing that I want to mention, of course, is that you are a very experienced and very well recommended practitioner and teacher and facilitator in the area of goddess oriented. Neo-pagan. Would you call it shamanism? I don't know whether I could. Well, let me see. Do you want to use that term?
Well, I would call it shamanism because, I think of myself as a shamanic witch, but not all witches are shamans, and obviously not all shamans are witches. So, so it's, in my case, it is both of those things, and that Wicca is my kind of my primary tradition, but I am, oriented towards the shamanistic aspect. In other words, I don't just celebrate, the various rituals throughout the year, although I do celebrate them, but I'm really primarily oriented towards the work of the shaman, which is kind of going between the worlds and trying to create healing and balance.
Well, this is very, very good. This is kind of my orientation in ceremonial magic. When I first got into ceremonial magic, I looked at the state of it, and it seemed like the Golden Dawn and the OTO, all they were doing was a bunch of rituals, and I thought, gosh, we got to get somewhere with this, we got to go to some, we got to get out and get into the visionary state, And so that's been my approach, and I'm glad to see that's your approach too. And so when you say when you're training people, you're not so much training them in a ritual tradition as you are in an individual visionary mode. Is that would that be correct?
Well, I'm trying to give them enough ritual to form a good strong container. I definitely teach people how to cast a circle and create sacred space. I do think that's kind of the first step is to ground yourself within the context of sacred space and within the context of tradition. But from there, I'm mostly trying to give them actual hands-on experiences of what does it feel like to go into an individual trance? How about group trance? How do you work group trance? And how do you do chanting? And how do you make this magical tool or that? I'm trying to give them kind of as many tools as possible within the course of a year, and so that they will have the basis from which to then kind of generate their own tradition and decide what they themselves want to continue to make use of as they go through their magical life.
That seems to be the thrust these days, is to empower the individual and give them just enough structure to and just enough technique to find their own, Joseph Campbell calls that still center point. And within themselves, that's an excellent way to put it. Well, Lady Kerdwin, I have really, really enjoyed having you on and discussing your books, your wonderful books, your novels, and your insights on the channeling process. And your description of how you're doing your work. I want to say again that meeting you up there, Joe's, when we did the Farifarian ceremony, Sandra and I both were charmed. And I think you're a wonderful lady, and I think you're doing a terrific job. And I really, really I wish you all the best luck and the best fortune.
Well,
so,
thanks so much.
I'll get on to wrapping up the rest of the show. So, blessed be and merry meet and merry part and merry meet again.
Blessed be.
Okay, so next week we have something really, really, really important, and something that will be of really special interest. But we aren't going to say exactly what it is yet, because we aren't really sure we're going to be able to do it. But if we can do it next week, we will. So be sure and tune in when we present the Hermetic Hour next week, and we will publish an abstract as soon as possible on what next week's show will be all about, and don't miss it.